This episode of HPC Wire Soundbite is sponsored by AppPro International Incorporated, a leading developer of innovative supercomputing solutions uniquely positioned to support high-performance computing markets. www.appro.com.
This is HPC Wire Soundbite, your weekly source of commentary and insight on the HPC stories shaping the industry. With Michael Feldman, editor of HPC Wire, and Addison Snell, CEO of Intersect 360 Research. And now, here are your hosts, Michael Feldman and Addison Snell.
Whatever happened to personal genomics?
And how high is the high in HPC?
Hello, everyone, and good morning for HPC Wire Soundbite for June 3rd, 2011, available every Friday on iTunes and Stitcher. I'm Michael Feldman, editor of HPC Wire, and I'm joined by Addison Snell, CEO of Intersect 360 Research. Hey, good morning, Addison.
Good morning, Michael. How are we doing?
We're doing well.
Well, that's good, because I got a question. Whatever happened to personal genomics?
I was just thinking about that. In fact, we reported on that a little bit this week in HPC Wire. And yeah, it seems like, you know, a few years ago, everybody was talking about this. In fact, for the last 10 years, people have been talking about this. And, you know, we sort of all expected to have our genomes sort of analyzed by now. We should all know what diseases we're gonna be getting and down the road. But it never quite came off. It always seems like that's just over the horizon.
I've got mine in a Petri dish right here, but it's been sitting there for months, and I haven't done anything with it.
Yeah, you might want to redo that. Yeah, I mean, supposedly you just go into a doctor's office, give them some saliva, come back, and for a few $100, you can get your genome back. But actually, it doesn't work that way. There was a recent presentation at an NCSA session back in early May, and Dr. Victor Jonganil, a senior researcher at NCSA and at the Institute of Genomic Biology at the University of Illinois there, talked about this in some detail. And the problem is not really that genomics isn't cheap to do. It sort of is cheap. I mean, you can do some sort of genomics for a few $100, even less than $1,000 certainly. But those little tests that you see advertised around, they're only looking at certain areas of the genome where there's sort of well-known problems maybe for specific types of diseases.
Right.
To do your whole genome, you know, a terabyte of data, and to map that out is not – it takes a little bit longer. It's a little bit more expensive than that. It's a few $1,000s. But the problem really is the computation. To map it, to really do interesting comparisons, takes a week of computation, and that's not $1,000 worth of stuff. That's a lot.
So, but the computation keeps getting cheaper. I mean, do we think this is still on the horizon here, or are we going to have it? It's just a question of a good idea whose time is yet to come.
Well, yeah, Jonganil thinks, you know, we're sort of on the upside of this curve. I mean, basically there was this hype cycle, and then there was disillusionment. And now we're sort of on this enlightenment cycle where we're sort of gathering the pieces together. So, yeah, computation obviously is getting better. I mean, there's still problems. The computation still with, you know, with typical supercomputing structure takes about a week to do for a whole genome, and still a few $1,000s to even sequence the genome. But that's really the cheapest part, the computation. But the software is not very good yet. The software is still developing. It's done by, according to him, it's not really being done by professional programmers. It's done by genomic algorithms, and the algorithms are good, but the software isn't quite up to speed yet. So there's a lot of sort of, there's a few missing pieces, and it's coming into play, but it's still not going to be, you know, the $1,000 genome. But that's what they're working towards. There's initiatives to basically work towards that price point with the computation in mind, but that's still the most expensive part.
Yeah, I think this is a common thread in new technologies coming out, that you do have a hype cycle when something looks like it's going to be possible for the first time. But if you really want to look for what's going to be the hot new thing this year, I think a lot of times the best thing to do is look for what was supposed to be the hot new thing 5 years ago and then didn't quite happen, right? And
right.
Then it finally becomes really feasible for a mass market approach.
Right, right. Yeah, I think we tend to think sort of exponentially in the short term and linearly in the long term, whereas we should actually be doing the reverse. In this case, I mean, the interesting thing about this, the personal genomics story, is the sort of the physical part, the actual sequencing part, got ahead of the computation. In other words, you know, we had Moore's law and basically, you know, HPC type acceleration on the computation side, which is, you know, going very quickly, but right. The sequencing went even more quickly. So that went by, I think they were doubling, you know, every 6 months as far as price performance, and that got way ahead of the computation. And now you've got, you know, like I said, a terabyte for a human genome, and there's all these other genomes that people are studying out there. So the computation just couldn't keep up with it. So now, you know, it's starting to catch up, and the software's starting to catch up as well. So things are starting to even out. But it was sort of an interesting little industry in that, you know, computation in this case was behind the curve.
Yeah, well, it's computation, and then you also mentioned the scalability of the software, because the software, even if you have all the cores there, the software has to be able to take advantage of it, and that's another challenge in genomics and elsewhere.
Right, and there's only, I think he mentioned, there's only one genomic assembler that even uses MPI, and it's a fairly new code anyway. So, right, some of these codes don't scale, and I don't know how many cores or CPUs that uses. I don't think it even scales very well, but at least it uses MPI. A lot of these genomics assembler codes use other techniques that aren't well-suited for scalable systems like HPC clusters.
Yep. Well, what we'll do then is, this is actually the topic of a survey question that we asked recently, looking specifically at application scalability. Why don't we take a quick sponsor break, then we'll come back and talk about application scalability in general.
APRO is a leading developer of innovative supercomputing solutions, uniquely positioned to support high-performance computing markets, focusing on medium to large-scale deployments where lower total cost of ownership is essential. APRO accelerates technical applications and business results through outstanding price per performance, fast time to market solutions based on the latest open standards technologies, innovative cluster tools, and management software packaged with HPC professional services and support. APRO supercomputing solutions enable scientists and engineers in academia, government, and industry to use highly technical, compute-intensive applications for scientific research discovery, data modeling, engineering simulations, and seismic visualization. APRO's headquarters is located in Milpitas, California, with offices in Korea and Houston, Texas.
Okay, we were just talking about genomics and how there were sort of scalability challenges there. I mean, you just did a survey around this, Addison, across the HPC spectrum of applications about what kind of what scalability looks like out there for different types of users. What did you find out with what people are able to scale to these days?
Right. We did a broad technology survey in a lot of different areas. We asked about accelerators. We asked about pricing, tape, storage, file systems, unstructured data, all kinds of facilities, all kinds of things. But in particular, I put a challenge out on Twitter and said, you know, we're going to run this survey, and offered my Twitter followers a chance to suggest a question, and I would pick one and report on it on the podcast and on the Twitter account. And the one I selected was, people wanted to know about how high people's applications scaled. So we asked the question two different ways. One was, for your largest HPC application, what's the maximum number of cores it scales to? And then for typical applications that you run frequently, what's a typical scalability for those applications? So we looked at it the two different ways, and you know, we gave ranges for respondents. But what we found was, for the maximum scalability of the largest HPC application, at our respondent sites, the 50th percentile was around 160 processors. So half the application scaled more than that, and half scaled less than that.
Okay. Well, that's 160. So that's 160 processors.
Sorry, right? 160 cores. I should have said 160 cores, which is actually a little lower than you might have thought.
That's probably about what I would have thought. That maps to a medium-sized cluster nowadays, given core counts. So,
right,
considering that probably that's what most people have, that that sort of makes sense. I mean, but there was a range. I mean, that was a 50th percentile. Where was sort of the distribution across from the bottom to the top?
Yeah, the interesting thing was that it was really spread out. It did not come in bunches, where 10% of our respondents had maximum scalability at 4 cores or less, and 12% had applications that scaled to over 10,000 cores. So very long tails out in either direction. And, you know, to be an HPC and you're looking at 10% of the respondents saying they don't have an application that scales beyond 4 cores. Now, I went in and looked at those respondents to see, you know, did that really make sense? And it kind of did. I mean, we were finding them in consumer products manufacturing, some entertainment where you're and even genomics, where you're talking about, you might be running multiple instances of a single application, but any individual instance of that application is running on a single socket or a single node that doesn't have more than 4 cores.
Hmm. Yeah.
And that included some academic research where you get these really small entry-level academic sites.
Yeah, 4 cores. Boy, that barely seems like HPC. I think my word processor uses 4 cores nowadays.
Yeah, well, but these aren't necessarily systems that were installed in the last month, right? We'll probably drop those off, and you'll start seeing minimums that have to be 8 cores. But, you know, these could be academic research centers that are writing their own scripts to, you know, to run on a node of the academic supercomputer site, right?
Right, right.
To do something. So, you know, my application only runs to 4 cores, and then I've run it, and I'm publishing my thesis.
And then at the other end, of course, you've got the, you know, in the thousands, those are the national lab applications, presumably, and the big supercomputing centers.
Sure, some large weather simulations up there. You know, there are codes that run that way. So, you know, then we also looked at what the typical scalability was over the same types of ranges. And then typical scalability, of course, tends to drop from there. Any guess, Michael, where the 50th percentile is when you look at typical scalability?
So these are like common, not their maximum, but their common applications.
Common applications that you run frequently, how high do they typically scale? Where's the 50th percentile?
Let's see. If the maximum was 160, I'd say the typical would be maybe 40 cores.
Yeah, you're right on it. Yeah, at 40 cores, you're at the 52nd percentile. So 50th is in that 30 to 40 range. Yeah, in the high 30s. So, you know, we talk about HPC and we get diverted a lot into thinking about the largest systems, the largest cores, because those are fascinating. But most of the workflows most of the time are taking place really in the entry level and mid-range.
Yeah, so where's the missing middle? I mean, those are small clusters. That's pretty good. I mean, you figure that if people have maximum applications, they need to buy the maximum size system, I guess. So they have to buy a mid-size cluster with 160, but sounds like if they weren't doing that, they could get by with much smaller systems.
Well, yeah, but with regards to the missing middle, don't confuse the scalability of an application with what's the size of the system. Someone might have very large systems installed, but they're commonly using it in little bite-sized chunks because the individual applications don't scale that high.
That's true.
So why don't we take another break, and then we'll come back and I can do a stat of the week from a different part of the survey.
This episode of HPC Wire Soundbite has been sponsored by APRO International Incorporated, leading developers of innovative supercomputing solutions uniquely positioned to support high-performance computing markets. www.apro.com.
So, Michael, we've been talking about this technology survey that we've run. Another area that we asked questions about was looking at the use of different tools to study large-scale unstructured data. So this is kind of the Hadoop side of things. Do you hear much about that in the people you talk to?
Yeah, sort of on the periphery. But, yeah, Hadoop is getting a big following now, not just in HPC, obviously, but across the spectrum, especially in the analytics space. It's sort of becoming the de facto model, at least for the vast majority of people. But, yeah, we do hear about it. I'd be interested to hear sort of how much it's penetrated sort of our HPC user base.
Right. So, yeah, this was something I was actually surprised at the high incidence of, because I do see a lot of Hadoop, but not so much in the – I didn't expect it so much in the traditional HPC sense, because it's a different – type of big data, where, you know, in the Hadoop world, big data means these broad, wide scale, like internet search, MapReduce kinds of things. And HPC, right, big data, I tend to associate with 12 terabyte seismic sets, right?
Right.
It's a sort of a different thing. But we asked, what technologies people were using to evaluate or evaluating to analyze massive unstructured data. And over 70% said that they were using something, or evaluating something for, only 27% saying they're not analyzing, they don't have large unstructured data.
Okay.
Now, the most common thing was about half of people saying they use visualization to do it. But after that, Hadoop was cited by 30% of the respondents.
Wow. Okay. That is a good chunk of the population there. Yeah, right. But not too surprising. It's an open technology, and HPCers love open technologies, and it's available. So yeah, people are adopting it.
I still think that number might be a little bit high because of the way we asked using or evaluating. I might like to get under that a little further and take a look at how many people actually have it in use versus they're thinking this Hadoop thing might be a good idea.
Yeah. Now, I will tell you, some things I have heard recently is sort of some of the maybe what you call second generation sort of analytics are sort of going beyond Hadoop. I mean, people like SAS and some other people I've talked to think Hadoop is not an optimal framework for doing the advanced analytics, the type of advanced analytics that you need for HPC in a lot of cases. So I think we're seeing sort of a first generation type of analytics using Hadoop, but I'm not sure how it'll play out over the next few years as far as the technology.
We also asked about other tools as well, like Dryad and Amazon Elastic MapReduce, massively parallel databases, other analytics tools, and all of them got some scores. But Hadoop is the interesting one that a lot of people are talking about.
Yep. Well, not surprising. Good data. Thanks, Addison.
My pleasure.
Interested to see the breakdown of more of that as it comes out.
All right, you got it.
All right, until next week, we'll wrap it up and we'll report on what's new in the news in the coming week.
Great. Thanks a lot, Michael. I'll look forward to talking to you again next week.
You've been listening to HPC Wire Soundbite with Michael Feldman and Addison Snell. Got a question or comment for Michael or Addison? Email soundbite@hpcwire.com. HPC Wire Soundbite is available every Friday afternoon from iTunes or at hpcwire.com. HPC Wire, the leading source for global news and information covering the ecosystem of high productivity computing.